I really appreciate you joining us today. My name is John Hansen. My guest here for the last half hour is Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers. All right, we can't avoid it. Obviously, former President Trump. There's the New York case of with the prosecutor that's the district attorney, that's brought against Trump. There's potentially the Georgia one. There's potentially the Department of Justice. But the one that's in the news right now is a civil case about an alleged rape mm-hmm. that happened in a clothing store. The alleged victim, E.J. Carroll, who was a well-known writer for a long time, alleging that President Trump raped her. And also there's a defamation rolled into this, too, because President Trump has obviously gone on the offensive saying he didn't do this and then questioning her character, saying many things. I don't want to get into the politics of this, of course.
Yeah, I think it's a good case to discuss. Like, there's a couple interesting legal issues.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
Let's start there.
And trial.
So, first of all, civil case, not a criminal case.
Correct. So, it's a civil case brought by an individual against Trump, another individual, obviously. The remedy is monetary damages.
Mm-hmm.
The standard of proof is different than a criminal case, much lower. Preponderance of the evidence, which is explained to the court as more likely than not.
So like 50%
yeah,
plus
and
one.
Sometimes the judges actually give the example of the scales of justice. It tips essentially anything more than 50% is that kind of the idea. So if you're the plaintiff, you love that standard because it's just more likely than not. In a criminal case, as you know, it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt,
mm-hmm.
which we in the defense side obviously tried to play up heavily that it's such a high burden of proof, such a high standard. And it's tough if you're on the defense side in a civil case because you feel like, wow, more likely than not is not a high burden, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think one of the big questions people have is how could the case be brought from a timing standpoint, because the events occurred, the sexual assault allegations occurred in the 1990s. So mm-hmm. people are saying, well, how could the case even be brought? So New York, like some other states, passed a Adult Survivors Act, which meant that people who experienced sexual assault when they were above the age of 18, their claims, if they hadn't brought them within 1 or 2 years under New York law, would have been extinguished by the statute of limitations. But this law allowed that the statute of limitations to be extended for essentially 1 year. There was like a 1 year window under New York law where people who had such a claim
from the past could bring
the claim. So
if they were adults and they had been sexually assaulted, there's a 1 or 2 year window where you could
a 1 year window. So hypothetically, let's say let's say someone was over 18.
Mm-hmm.
in 1995,
mm-hmm.
and they never brought a civil case.
Okay. This is just for a civil case.
And okay. so obviously, typically that case would be time barred. It'd be barred by the statute of limitations because they didn't file it on time. Under New York law at the time, I don't know what it was. It's probably 1 year or 2 years or 5 years. So New York, recognizing that in the past, the system has been historically kind of dissuades people from bringing claims. It was a recognition of that part, part of a package of legislation that kind of arose out of Me Too. So what it said was, hey, if you have a claim that would be otherwise barred by the statute of limitations, you can bring that civil case within this 1 year time period.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And people might be saying, well, why wouldn't you report it right then and there? Time and time again, often sexual abuse survivors are currently in abusive relationships. They fear retaliation. There are a lot of reasons why they wouldn't, and they still, in many people's view, deserve some justice. Okay, so that's why this case
is hard. So that's
why
the case can be brought. But as you pointed out, there's a component of this case which has nothing to do with or doesn't kind of invoke that statute of limitations issue. There's also defamation claims brought by the plaintiff who says, hey, look, Trump defamed me publicly by making statements against me that are defamatory, such as I'm a liar or I made this up, stuff like that. But obviously, the heart of the case is the sexual assault rape allegations.
Right. Why isn't President Trump in that room? Is it his right not to be? What could happen if he was there?
Great trial question. So in a civil case, the defendant doesn't have to be there, right? In a criminal case, if you don't show up, they'll either make you show up, or they could try you in absentia, what it's called. But typically, if you're in custody, you have no choice. You're going to be brought by the marshals, right?
Yeah.
Or otherwise brought to that court. So you have to appear. But what the big difference is in a civil case, so the defendant can't be required to appear. But if they do appear, the other side could call you as a witness. So Trump really, yeah. So Trump's non-appearance in the case really has two dimensions. Okay, one is I think the public narrative that hey, I don't think much of this case. It's BS. I'm not going to give it any credence, right? But the more practical thing, and the reason why I think he's not there, is because if he's sitting in the courtroom, he could be called as a witness.
Versus in a criminal trial, it's up to the defense whether you want to go up.
Correct, because the difference in a criminal trial, you have the right to assert your Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate yourself. The government can't call you as a witness. The defense lawyer can put their client on the defendant, but they don't have to, right? So the problem in this Trump civil case, if he was sitting there, they clearly would have put him on a stand. And then if he said something differently than his deposition, they would have impeached him by showing excerpts from his deposition where he said something different.
Impeachment in the sense, not in a political sense, impeached defendant.
That's an interesting term. So in civil and criminal trials, one of the big concepts is what we attorneys call impeachment, right? All that means is that you've said something prior to trial that's different than what you're saying at trial. So, for instance, John, if you were charged with a crime and you'd given a statement to law enforcement, and then you get on the stand and say something entirely different, we can impeach you by bringing forward that statement you previously made.
What's the punishment in a civil case of impeachment? Or is it just the juror is made aware he's impeached himself, that use that as you will.
Of course. Well, of course, it's stronger than that, because let's say you show something, you're asking him a very material question, a very substantive question at trial, and he says something completely opposite. And you say, hey, sir, you gave a deposition, back 2 years ago, you're under oath, you swore to tell the truth, you did tell the truth, right? And then you play that question and him saying something entirely different, right? So you don't get to, it's not like TV where you get to turn to the jury and say, hey, he's a liar. But in your closing argument, you're saying, you saw how this person testified. They're completely lying to you.
They're not hauled away in handcuffs or anything.
No, impeachment
happens.
Is just you're trying to show that what they said at trial is not truthful.
Okay,
it's not
so
credible.
He doesn't want to take the stand, and he can be forced to if he's in the room because it's a civil case. He's exercising his complete right. He's absolutely 100% allowed to not be there.
To not show up, yeah. It's not a Fifth Amendment question. It's just his right not to show up for the trial.
So he's allowed to do that. No problems there. Okay, so they're playing, and this is the big news, they're playing his deposition to the jury. Is that common?
Yeah, so oftentimes, because he's not there, the great thing is they get to designate all or portions of his testimony. You're not gonna designate typically his whole testimony because it's too long. It's not all relevant, right? So you're gonna designate before the trial, hey, we're gonna play, page 5, lines 14 to 22 of the transcript, and then we're gonna play these pages and these pages. And of course, you want to play the most powerful, relevant stuff. And so they have the right to do that.
Can the defense say, can you also play these?
Correct. Yeah. So the defendant gets to counter-designate. So in the Trump trial, I'm sure that the defense lawyer counter-designated certain excerpts, certain portions where he's denying the allegations and saying things that are favorable to him.
Of course.
But the benefit from the plaintiff's attorney standpoint, they get to show these great excerpts from his deposition. He's not going to take the stand to try to explain them away. And quite frankly, as you pointed out before we went on the air, he made some real blunders at his deposition. They showed him an exhibit. Hey, Mr. Trump or President Trump are showing you exhibit number such and such. And it was a picture of the victim. And he thought it was his wife.
His first wife, yeah.
Which the trouble with that is, his very public statement is, I never would have done anything with this woman who's the plaintiff in the case.
She's
not my type. She's not good looking, essentially, right?
And he said that in the deposition, too.
Correct. But yet, here he is saying that the person who's the plaintiff is my wife. So that was a huge blunder. And there were other blunders, too.
I want to say that he said the picture was blurry. I didn't see the picture. I saw the picture. It wasn't blurry to me. Yeah. Maybe it was in the room. I want to put that out there.
Yeah, the funny thing that happened was they showed him the exhibit. He was very clear and definitive that was his wife. And then it kind of looks like his counsel's pointing to, the picture. And then he says, oh, hold on. It's really blurry. I can't tell. So it wasn't very credible. But this is a perfect example of a case that will hinge upon credibility, which most cases do.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in a case like this, the jury's going to be keenly interested in who they believe. Of course, do they believe the victim? Is she credible? Did she hold up under cross-examination? Does she have any motive to testify falsely? Will they hold it against her that she didn't press criminal charges or come forward earlier or file suit? All those issues go into the jury's determination of who they believe here, right?
Right.
And they only
have to do 51%.
Correct. And one thing that helps her is there is some corroboration. There was what's called an outcry, meaning at the time of the occurrence back in the day, she was able to put two witnesses on the stand who testified, hey, at the time, she reported this conduct to me, which of course would enhance her credibility that she really did tell people about what happened. And then the jurors still have to determine, well, these people say that she said that back then. Are they credible?
Are they credible?
Do they have a motive to testify falsely? Are they so much in her camp that they would say anything to support her story? So credibility is all throughout this Trump civil trial. There's no question.
Way to break that all down for us. We'll do more with Mike Leonard in a moment. LeonardTrialLawyers.com. What's the phone number, Mike?
312-380-6559.